Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. The Center for Disease Control released a report this weekend that reveals in 2006, 56,300 people were infected with HIV in the United States, a rate 40% higher than previously estimated. The new data also confirm that the highest infection rates are among gay and bisexual men and disproportionately among African Americans. This report has renewed a call to action among advocates and government officials all over the nation and internationally to do more to combat HIV/AIDS. Joining us to explain the new numbers and what they mean, for New York City, we have Dr. Monica Sweeney, Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV/AIDS Prevention Control for the New York City Department of Health. And joining us from the 17th Annual International AIDS Conference in Mexico City is Dr. Marjorie Hill, CEO of Gay Men's Health Crisis. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for the invitation.
Good morning.
Dr. Hill, there are thousands of scientists and AIDS advocates from all over the world in Mexico City at the International AIDS Conference. Has this report shaped the conversation there at all?
Well, you know, it's really been a very interesting experience that once the CDC announced the new numbers, that many of the conversations that have been had have really been focused on the domestic challenges around HIV and AIDS. And while there are many problems and issues in the Global South, as it's referred to, outside of the Americas, this report highlights that we really need both as an international community, but specifically in terms of those of us who are from New York and from the United States, to focus on the domestic AIDS epidemic.
So did this sound the alarm bells? I mean, was there a sense of sort of things are okay in the U.S. and we need to be focusing on the rest of the world? And was this report a shift, or is that overstating it?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting juxtaposition. For those of us who provide services, we have had a sense that there is a significant numbers of individuals who are at risk for HIV, who aren't getting the prevention and education messages, and that there are individuals who are, in fact, living with HIV who do not know their status. And much of our work and focus of our work has been targeting those individuals. The degree of that gap, I think, has been quantified by this report. But the reality of our needing to do more, both in terms of education and prevention and testing, are clearly the focus that we have had in terms of our programming for the last couple of years.
Dr. Monica Sweeney, we're now about 30 years into the AIDS epidemic almost. How could this happen? It seems so shocking that in 2008 we could say, oh no, we were wrong, the rates of infection are 40% higher than we thought.
You know, the issue here is not that the epidemic has changed and the numbers have changed significantly. It's that they're now able to be quantified and counted accurately. And it's a new technology doing a much better job of getting accurate numbers out than has been heretofore possible. And so the epidemic, we knew it was there. As Dr. Hill just mentioned, we've been working on the issues of prevention, and we knew where the epidemic is. We know where the epidemic is. This is a better tool to quantify the epidemic. And if we find that there are people that have not been counted or it's moved to some direction that we didn't know, this tool will help to do it.
Now, what else did we learn from this new technology? Did we learn more about where the infection is?
It's the numbers and the people infected, the risk groups, men who have sex with men and blacks, are still are the predominant groups affected. This is what was already known. And what we will see going forward is whether or not there is any other subpopulation that has not been heretofore known. But at this point, the numbers that we have been corroborated with the subgroups, I should say, that have been affected are the ones that we know are affected. The epidemic is disproportionately affecting the Black community and men who have sex with men.
Now, these are national numbers. What does the picture look like in New York?
You are asking a question that I'll be better able to answer once the information has been calculated for New York City. Our department is working on doing that as expeditiously as possible, and then we will know exactly what the numbers are in New York City using the new methodology.
Dr. Hill, in the early years of the AIDS epidemic, it was a certain death sentence. And people got very sick and died very quickly. Has the fact that there are these drug cocktails in some ways made it more difficult to prevent? Does it create an attitude among people that, oh, if I do get infected, it can be handled?
Well, you know, we are very concerned, obviously, and we both in our partnership with the New York City Department of Health and with the CDC and with other sister agencies have really been challenged by what we call kind of this HIV/AIDS complacency. A positive outgrowth of the CDC's release of new numbers and eventually New York City's framing of how this new technology will impact New York City is that people are talking about HIV/AIDS again, and there are many of the individuals who are in very high-risk populations don't really feel that they are at risk. Women is a perfect example, and Black women are particularly, as a group, at risk for HIV infection for a whole host of reasons, but not necessarily feel that they're at risk. And so we think that one real opportunity around this is to kind of sound the alarm, if you will, around those targeted populations. But HIV is no longer a death sentence. There are very effective treatments that are available, and in working with one's medical provider and continuing to do the kinds of behavioral activities in terms of safer sex, individuals can lead long and productive lives. But the challenge really is making sure that those individuals who are at greatest risk get the information and get tested.
My guests are Dr. Marjorie Hill, the CEO of Gay Men's Health Crisis. She's speaking to us from Mexico City, the 17th International Conference on AIDS. And Dr. Monica Sweeney, the Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV/AIDS Prevention Control for the New York City Department of Health. I'm Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. Dr. Sweeney, the analysis in the recent CDC report shows that in the early days of the epidemic, the infection rate peaked at about 130,000 new infections per year. And since then, it's gone to about 50,000 and stayed in that range. What has been so challenging about bringing it down further?
One of the things has already been alluded to. When people have lost the fear factor, HIV was once a dreaded disease. And as a result of it being a dreaded disease, people in communities like in San Francisco and in New York, to a slightly lesser extent, they became their own best advocates. And that means that they said, this behavior, this risk behavior that you're taking that is causing people to die is unacceptable. And right now, that's one of the factors that's missing. And so the fact that it's a chronic disease now, if you get tested early and get into treatment and stay in treatment, people don't have the fear of it that they once had. The other thing is that many gay men have the feeling, and this is not just here in New York, but I've talked to colleagues all over the country, that I'm eventually going to get HIV anyway. And so the effort that needs to be put forth to decrease risk is lacking in many instances, or people get what they call prevention fatigue. And so those combination of issues, the fact that it is a chronic disease, if it's diagnosed and treated, and that people get, quote, prevention fatigue, and all of the other issues in the minority community that contribute to this have made it very difficult to bring the numbers down. But, you know, I just have to say we should focus on some of the successes, too, because there have been successes.
What about, though, I mean, just to push a little further on that, when you say many gay men say that they think they're going to get it anyway, I mean, is this of all ages? Is this across the board? And how true is that? I mean, what percentage of gay men do eventually get infected?
No, it is not across the board, because in New York City, the men who have sex with men, the numbers have decreased in men 30 and over. But it is the men under 30 who have no recollection. I mean, they didn't live through the terrible early 80s and 90s to the mid-90s before there was HART. And so there can't be any of this collective memory of how terrible things were. So no, it affects younger gay men who have sex with men, much more than older gay men. As a matter of fact, the rate has decreased for new infections in men over 30 by 22%, while it has gone up by 40% in men under 30.
And I think the other issue is around how this plays out in terms of both race in particular and class. And so when we look at young black men, gay men, or young black men who are having sex with other men of color, those rates are even higher. And so there's some real challenges. And I think part of the issue that is also complicating our HIV prevention and education efforts is that although HIV is a chronic and manageable disease, if one gets appropriate care and treatment, the stigma around HIV has not changed dramatically in the 27 years of the epidemic. And that's true.
But I have to say, you know, to wait for the stigma to go away, we're going to bury a lot more people. There's been effective cure for TB for 60 years, and there's still stigma attached to having TB. So while we need to address stigma, we need to work on people knowing their status, which is good for them to get into care and treatment so that it's a manageable disease. But it's also good for public health and interrupting the epidemic, because they don't go around inadvertently transmitting HIV for 8 to 10 years for the people who don't learn that they're HIV positive until they have already advanced to AIDS, and it's 25% of the people in New York City.
Well, we have no argument that more people need to know their status, and there needs to be much more active participation around safer sex and, you know, those types of nuances around care. But the reality to say that stigma is not impacting the epidemic is not accurate in terms of at least in terms of the individuals that we see and in terms of the communities at risk. So I'm not suggesting that we just bury our heads in the sand and say, oh, woe is us, there's stigma. But we do need to recognize that and do anti-stigma work, that we can have all the testing, free testing in the world, but if people are embarrassed, ashamed, reluctant to go go and get those tests, then we're really missing the boat. I mean, if we can have people who...
But that's why we need to integrate testing into routine medical care. And although, Marjorie, we agree on more things than we disagree, one of the things that keeps the stigma attached is the way HIV is handled. And when we routinize care and remove these antiquated laws that probably served people well in the 1980s, it does not serve people well in 2008. And we need to remove the stigma by having it be a part of routine medical care. You don't have to go any special place to get tested. You go to your doctor for your annual physical or to the emergency room for a broken leg, and they test you for HIV. By routinizing care and removing many of the barriers, we can also help to destigmatize it.
And you're absolutely right, Dr. Sweeney, that we don't disagree about the need to have more routine offering of HIV. At the same time, though, individuals who are stigmatized, who don't have medical care, whose doctors are reluctant to take medical histories, who don't encourage them around safer sex or even inquire about that, that is also part of the problem. So only looking at the legal remedies is not affording us the opportunity to look at one very key issue, and that is providers' education and providers' comfort around talking about and inquiring around sexual matters.
Dr. Hill, we only have a couple moments left, and I do want to find out about another big issue right now. Which is, I'm wondering if there's a talk in Mexico City about the question of whether the funds, particularly under the Bush administration, are going to Africa and are not being used to prevent AIDS domestically. First of all, is that true? And secondly, is that something that's a topic of conversation?
Well, actually, GMHC several months ago, along with other partner organizations, really called for the United States to have a national AIDS strategy. Our PEPFAR dollars, our foreign aid relief for AIDS that goes to countries outside of the United States requires that each of those countries prepare a coordinated national plan that includes the medical community, the business community, the faith community.
And we don't have that in the U.S.?
And 27 years into the epidemic, the United States does not require such a plan for its HIV/AIDS treatment. So that, yes, there's lots of corporations and foundations who are doing work with government, but it's not all necessarily coordinated. There are faith institutions who may have plans and partnerships with some corporations, with the Department of Health, but there's not an overriding requirement that it's all coordinated.
And so is that something that's a big topic of conversation in Mexico City?
As a matter of fact, I was at a press conference yesterday here in Mexico City that Congressmember Barbara Lee and many others of us asked for they're sort of framing it as a domestic PEPFAR. A plan that says we in the United States have to ensure that, A, all of our federal social services and support agencies are coordinating care together.
And how do the African nations feel about that? I mean, is there a sense of threat?
We are not opposed to the federal government supporting countries, underdeveloped countries, and doing PEPFAR work. This is not an either-or. But we're saying that part of the success of PEPFAR has been this coordinated effort.
Explain PEPFAR.
PEPFAR is the U.S. response on relief dollars that go to about 15 countries that have significant HIV/AIDS in those countries and have significant financial challenges.
It's the President's Emergency Fund.
Emergency Fund for AIDS relief.
All right.
Okay.
Dr. Sweeney, we need to wrap up, but does the CDC report change New York City's plans at all?
You know, we are going to continue to do prevention that we know works. We have data to support. But we are continuing to be partners with community-based organizations, faith-based organizations. There is an AIDS commission in New York City with all of the partners around the table that produced the report. We're having bringing together another one of them. So we will continue to do those things that we know work, distributing condoms. You know about our big condom program, expanding testing. We're doing social network recruiting for testing. We are doing a media campaign aimed for MSMs, which is going to launch soon on the Internet.
MSM, that's men having
men
sex.
Men who have sex with men on the Internet, where they advertise for dating and social networking. So we are going to continue the programs that we're doing, and we are getting the new data based on using the new formula. And any way that we need to redirect resources based on the new information is what we will do.
Thanks very much, Dr. Monica Sweeney, Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV/AIDS Prevention Control for the New York City Department of Health.
Thank you.
And from Mexico City, Dr. Marjorie Hill, the CEO of Gay Men's Health Crisis. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
We'll be back with an analysis of the Obama-McCain energy plans right after this.